Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the revelation that Donald Trump held an hour-long second meeting with Vladimir Putin at the recent G20 meeting that the White House did not mention, at which there was only a Russian interpreter and no notes were taken, leaving the U.S. government to rely on whatever record the Russian government produces. James Golgaya, the dean of the School of International Service at American University, who was director of Russian, Ukrainian, and Eurasian Affairs on the National Security Council and is the author of Power and Purpose, U.S. Policy Towards Russia After the Cold War, joins us. We will discuss his article at the Washington Post, "There Are No Notes on Trump's Meeting with Putin, That's a Big Deal," and the importance of memorandums of conversations known as memcons, which are not only important for the leaders themselves, but are invaluable for scholars and the historical record. Then, with the CBO estimating that 32 million more Americans will be uninsured under the new Republican Senate bill, we'll examine why the Republicans are having such a hard time repealing and replacing Obamacare, a seven-year-long mission, if not obsession, that is in disarray. James Marone, the professor of political science at Brown University and editor of Healthcare Policy in the USA and Germany, whose latest book is The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office, joins us to discuss how not just Obamacare is proving to have a powerful political constituency, but also Medicaid is proving durable since it covers the costs of retirement homes for most of the nation's elderly citizens. Then finally, with the president hosting Republican senators for lunch at the White House, where he issued a not-so-veiled threat to wayward senators, urging them to hammer out a health plan, adding, "We shouldn't leave town until this is complete." We will look into the conflicted politics of repeal and replace with Jonathan Cohn, a senior correspondent at the Huffington Post and author of Sick, The Untold Story of American Healthcare Crisis and Who Pays for It. He joins us to discuss his latest article at the Huffington Post, "Republicans Have a Way Out of the Healthcare Mess Working with Democrats." And before we begin, I'd like to invite you to the UCLA Hammer Forum that I'm moderating this coming Tuesday, July the 25th at 7:30 p.m., end of life options. Last year, California became the fifth and largest state to enact an assisted suicide law, the End of Life Option Act, allowing doctors to prescribe aid to dying medication. We'll have a very impressive group of medical professionals, along with the husband of the late Death with Dignity advocate, Brittany Maynard. Again, a week from yesterday, Tuesday, July the 25th at 7:30 p.m. at the UCLA Hammer Forum in Westwood, free and open to the public. Join me for End of Life Options. And joining us now is James Golgaya, who is the Dean of the School of International Service at American University, who has held a number of public policy appointments, including Director for Russian, Ukrainian, and Eurasian Affairs on the National Security Council, and the Henry A. Kissinger Chair at the Library of Congress, and the Edward Teller National Fellow at the Hoover Institution. His books include America Between the Wars from 11/9 to 9/11, Power and Purpose, U.S. Policy Towards Russia After the Cold War, and Not Whether But When, the U.S. Decision to Enlarge NATO. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Golgaya.
Thanks for having me.
And obviously, there is a pattern here of the Trump administration not admitting things happen, and then once they appear in the press, sort of grudgingly admitting they happen. But why do you think this meeting that took place at the G20 over dinner, I believe from the time the dessert was served for about an hour, President Trump had sat down next to President Putin without an interpreter, relying on the Russian interpreter and without taking notes. This was the second meeting, of course, that they had. The Trump administration saying, well, you know, all the world leaders were there. It was hardly a secret. But why does it? I was assumed that the White House always let the public know what they're up to. There's always a printout, isn't there?
Well, you know, the issue here really isn't about the public knowing what Trump and Putin are talking about as much as it is Trump's own national security team. If there's nobody there to take notes when the president has a substantive meeting with another head of state, then you don't have any notes that the national security advisor can review, that the staff who work on Russia issues can review, that the secretary of state can review. So they don't really have any idea what was said and what Trump and Putin might have discussed, what things might have needed to be followed up. So the issue really is that these kinds of meetings without having any kind of record is really hindering the Trump team in formulating a successful foreign policy.
Well, the National Security Advisor, General McMaster, was not included in the main meeting that took place, where there were only two businessmen, frankly, with about a year's experience at the most in government, up against a foreign policy pro and an intelligence pro on the Russian side. And my understanding is that Fiona Hill, that the Russians actually specifically didn't want her in there. And of course, she would have been the note taker and speaks Russian. She's the National Security Council specialist on Russia in the Trump White House.
Yes, and she should have been in that meeting, and so should General McMaster have also been at that meeting. And we saw how problematic it was that President Trump only had Secretary of State Tillerson there. President Putin had Foreign Minister Lavrov there. And we saw coming out of the meeting that Lavrov and Tillerson described the meeting very differently. And again, if you're General McMaster, or you're Fiona Hill, and you're trying to help the president formulate a policy toward Russia, and you're not really sure what was said, and you see the people who were there come out with different interpretations, you're really operating with at least one hand tied behind your back.
And in the case of the second meeting, is it the case that we have to entirely rely on the Russians for the record, since there was only a Russian interpreter?
Well, there won't be. I mean, I don't really see how on the U.S. side there will be any record. I can't imagine the Russian interpreter is going to be typing up notes to send to the NSC staff for them to be able to help. I don't think the NSC staff is going to really have any idea what was said. Trump may say to McMaster or to Jared Kushner or somebody else in the White House, here's what I discussed with President Putin in the interview that he gave to the New York Times today. He said he talked about adoptions, which of course is the same thing that Donald Trump Jr. Said he discussed in his infamous meeting last year. So again, all that his staff will know is whatever President Trump decides to tell them about the meeting, and then even then they won't really know if that's what was discussed or what exactly the substance was.
Well, the meeting from which the email chain, which had exposed the meeting that was previously not mentioned, there were so many people now, and every day there's a drip, drip, drip of a new attendee, the latest of which is somebody with a record in money laundering, and then you had a former Red Army counterintelligence officer and a lawyer who's been after Magnitsky, who was murdered in prison, and she represented the people who laundered $230 million of stolen tax money from the Russian Treasury. Not exactly a savory bunch, and it doesn't sound like the kind of people you need in a meeting to talk about adopting Russian children.
Yes. I mean, that meeting, there will be a lot for the special counsel to be investigating with respect to that meeting. And, certainly it's hard to imagine that the foremost thing on President Trump's mind to discuss with President Putin at the G20 meeting was adoptions again. There's a lot on the U.S.-Russia agenda, including Ukraine and Syria and North Korea, and above all, the Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. So if you're going to spend an hour talking to President Putin after dinner, it's just hard to imagine that adoptions is going to be your number one priority there.
And again, I'm speaking with James Golguy, who's the Dean of the School of International Service at American University. He's held a number of public policy appointments, including Director for Russian, Ukrainian, and Eurasian Affairs on the National Security Council. And he was the Henry A. Kissinger Chair at the Library of Congress and the Edward Teller National Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And his latest book is Not Whether But When, the U.S. Decision to Enlarge NATO. Now, when Ronald Reagan had private talks with Gorbachev in 1985 in Geneva, when they first met, and I believe he had subsequent private talks in Iceland and the other summits that took place, nobody was bothered by that because I don't think people questioned Ronald Reagan's patriotism and loyalty to the United States, but there is a cloud hanging over this president, which he has been the last person to shed. I mean, from the very beginning, he could have settled this whole idea of Russian collusion by coming out and condemning the very notion of that happening, and he never has, and it's very puzzling. And I think it's, without being partisan, you wonder. What's going on? Obviously, we're going to have to wait for a long time for the special prosecutor, but do you think that there is a difference between the level of trust that Americans had for Ronald Reagan and the level of trust that they have with Donald Trump?
Well, there were certainly plenty of people who criticized Ronald Reagan and opposed Ronald Reagan's policies. And, you know, that includes Republicans. Before Ronald Reagan met with Gorbachev in November 1985 for that first meeting that you just referenced. Newt Gingrich in Congress claimed that this, you know, would be the worst meeting for the West since Neville Chamberlain met Adolf Hitler at Munich in 1938. So, you know, there's a lot of people who conveniently forget how much they criticized President Reagan for the outreach to Gorbachev, and really, it's not really about that. When Reagan met Gorbachev in any of those meetings that you just cited, there was a record made. People in the government knew what had been discussed, and they could then move forward with policies that could help move the agenda of in that day the U.S.-Soviet relationship forward. If you're a staff member and you have no idea what was discussed by your president with another president, you don't know what was promised. You don't know what they might have talked about doing on this or that issue. And so you don't really have a way to help move the ball forward. And that's the big issue here, that it's not the first time that he's had meetings with other leaders where, as far as we know, there weren't any notes. And this just isn't good for making good policy.
So let's talk for a minute about these memorandums of conversations known inside the government as MEMCONs. They've obviously been the currency for high-level diplomacy for some time.
Yes, and so what happens typically, whether it's a phone call or whether it's a meeting, and again, it depends on how many people are involved. For example, on a presidential phone call, typically you would have several members of the National Security Council staff sitting in the Situation Room with headphones on, taking notes, and then producing a record of the call later that could be distributed in a limited way to people in the government so that they know what was discussed. In some cases, you've seen these photos of meetings with the president with lots of staff on each side in presidential meetings, and you'll have multiple note takers in those. And sometimes it's just the president with a plus one, as was the case in the first meeting at the G20 with the president and Secretary Tillerson there, and then you're really reliant on somebody who's at a high level and perhaps participating in the meeting, taking notes. And usually those MEMCONs, those memoranda of conversation, aren't as detailed. But, you know, if people are interested in these kinds of things, you know, just Google Henry Kissinger and MEMCONs, and, you know, all those declassified MEMCONs will come up in your Google search, and you can see what a real detailed memorandum of conversation looks like, the kind, for example, that Kissinger had with the Chinese during the time that he was National Security Advisor and Secretary of State. And you can see just how important these are for people working in the government. And of course, 30 years later, when they are declassified, they're incredibly important for scholars trying to reconstruct what was said and done.
So what is the explanation then for the resistance on the part of this president to share his conversations with world leaders? There is, you know, you can put it down to amateurism, because there certainly appears to be a lot of that in abundance in this White House. But the impression that some have is that this was, you know, not the meeting of two heads of state, but rather, you know, the kind of meeting that two mafia dons have.
Yeah, I don't. You know, there could be any number of explanations for the reluctance. I mean, it could be amateurism. It could also be that he doesn't like to have records made of his conversations. And I think, you know, he's really making a mistake and not really understanding. He may feel like, oh, it's not good to have a written record. Then people can have something to use against you. Not having a written record means, you know, for example, in this case, the Russians can say anything they want about what was said in the meeting, and there's no way to counter that. Oftentimes, these memoranda of conversation can provide some political cover. You know, we've seen how much journalists are getting from folks in the White House with respect to the leaks in the White House, and certainly President Trump may be very upset by that, but those leaks also can prove useful in some cases. People who know what the conversation is, and even the president himself, who want to sort of put the word out there of things that they're proud of, that they've been discussing with another head of state, they can use that memorandum of conversation in that way with journalists or later to provide some cover. So there are all sorts of good reasons to have these memorandum of conversation. And you know, as a scholar who wants scholars 30 years from now to be able to look back at this period and be able to really tell us what was really going on, the fact that there won't be much of a written record is going to make things very difficult.
Well, it must have been some kind of memcon that leaked out in the meeting that President Trump had in the Oval Office with Lavrov and Kislyak, the ambassador, where they were kind of yucking it up, and Trump referred to the head of the FBI, James Comey, as a nut job. That all came out. So do you think that maybe that's why Tillerson wasn't allowed into the meeting, that he just wants to keep the circle as narrow as possible because he's kind of afraid or upset or obsessed with leaks?
Well, so at these meetings like the G20, and this is the case of the G7 as well, the Group of Seven, advanced industrialized countries, there's often this head of state dinner where it's just the head of state, you know, sometimes the head of state and their spouses, and they don't have staff there, and staff are always very nervous about these dinners because they don't know what's being said. And it's not so much that, it's that, you know, he had a specific, as far as we now know, an hour-long meeting with President Putin, which is beyond simple dinnertime chit-chat. And so normally for a substantive meeting with another head of state, especially one that's, you know, going to go for an hour, you would want somebody there from your side, even if it's just your own interpreter, because the Russian interpreter works for President Putin. So he is going to do or, you know, conduct the translation in a way that's working for his boss. And so you at least want your own interpreter there so that you can have greater confidence about what you're saying is being translated the way you want to the other head of state.
So we could wake up and TASS and Pravda could have reported that the U.S. plans to pull out of NATO, right? I'm joking.
I hope not.
Right. Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, James Golgi.
Great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with James Golgi, who's the Dean of the School of International Service at American University, who's held a number of public policy appointments, including Director for Russian, Ukrainian, and Eurasian Affairs on the National Security Council. He's also was the Henry A. Kissinger Chair at the Library of Congress and the Edward Teller National Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And his latest book is Not Whether But When, the U.S. Decision to Enlarge NATO. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back examining why the Republicans are having such a hard time repealing and replacing Obamacare. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Marone, who's a professor of political science and urban studies at Brown University, noted for his analysis of popular participation and morality in American politics and his work on health policies. He's the author of the award-winning book, The Democratic Wish, and he is the editor of Healthcare Policy in the USA and Germany, The Politics of Healthcare Reform, and Wealthy, Healthy, and Fair, The Politics of Healthcare for a Good Society. His latest book is The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Marone.
Great to be back, Ian.
Well, thanks, James. And it's a little ironic, isn't it, after 7 years of bashing Obamacare and passing all kinds of House and Senate resolutions to kill it, I think something like about 60. It became a kind of ritual during Obama's presidency. But now the Republicans just simply can't get rid of it. It's kind of haunting them. It's a bit like the albatross in The Ancient Mariner, or, you know, out damn Spot in Lady Macbeth. I mean,
all those great metaphors for something hanging around your neck that you can't get rid of.
Right.
And it just goes back to one piece of wisdom, which is it's far easier to obstruct than it is to govern. There's another thing that's gone on here, and that the Republicans have ruefully been saying, which is they never expected Trump to win, and as a result, they never bothered to build their own plan. And usually, a president comes into office with a plan, if it's going to be successful, with a plan set to go. The worst thing you can do is try to design one on the fly. Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton discovered that. You really need something that's ready, that's been tested, that's been argued over, that the idea of trying to do it overnight, when really all you've had is a negative vision, is very, very difficult. And I think anybody who uses the healthcare system, can you breathe a sigh of relief that they didn't just throw something in order to give the president a victory without really taking some time and constructing something, even if it's only within their caucus, that has got some experience to it, that's got some people arguing over it. This was really a shambles of a piece of legislation.
But when you say give the president a victory, that is what it's all about. At least to my mind, it's pretty flagrant that this is a man who doesn't care about anybody but himself and his family. And he rather callously said yesterday, you know, we don't own it and we don't want to own it and we should repeal it. And we should repeal it and not even replace it. So he, in a very cavalier way, is perfectly happy to have 22 million, and now with this latest estimate from the CBO that 32 million Americans will be left uninsured by this new Republican bill. And he doesn't give a damn because it's all about his image. And 6 months in, you know, he hasn't got anything done, really, even though he claimed the other day to have got more done than FDR did in his first 6 months and Harry Truman. So you have to have the caveat that you got a president who lives in an alternative universe.
Yes. It turns out that Donald Trump was one of the great campaigners. We underestimated him again and again. And he just was extraordinarily adept at tweeting his way into the White House. And really the greatest come-from-behind victory in American history. So there was some question of whether he could take that unexpected set of skills and move it into actually governing. And now we're getting a pretty clear answer, and that answer is no. He just has one skill, which is making sure he's in the headline every day. That skill works great when you're running for the White House and you want to shove aside, starve, really, of media attention, your rivals. But he was nothing but mischievous in the Republican effort, and it's clear that the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, said several times, would you please stop? He, at one point, at least one of his groups, took out ads against a senator from Nevada who was expressing reservations, only affirming his resolve. He mocked the House bill, which he had once celebrated in a Rose Garden ceremony. He suddenly suggested they change course and simply repeal without replace. Each of those things really took a toll. So this is someone with no clue about public policy. A wonderful campaigner, but it's not translating. But Ian, there's something else we ought to talk about, and that is, apart from the shambles that is this White House, at least in terms of policy, it's the shambles that is the Republican coalition. That what is just striking here is that a coalition that first cobbled itself together under Ronald Reagan has now warring camps with very little in common. And we sort of, political scientists had been speculating that the next time the Republicans got into the majority over the last decade, they've been speculating that the next time the Republicans got into the majority, we would see great fissures in their coalition. And this health bill has really shown that. I mean, the idea that you've got the conservatives saying it doesn't go far enough and the moderates saying, good God, 22 million more uninsured people, depending on which version you're counting, but somewhere north of 20 million people without insurance. We just can't have that. It's really two different parties. So the really interesting story here is what happens to the Republicans. They have a majority, and it's not that they only lost two or three or four votes. Their reports out now are that the simple repeal can't get 40 votes, never mind the 50 that they're going to need. So this is a party that's now displaying enormous divisions. Very hard to govern that way, especially if you have a president who's got this sort of shambolic White House devoid of policy.
And again, I'm speaking with James Marone, who's a professor of political science and urban studies at Brown University, noted for his analysis of popular participation and morality in American politics and his work on health policies. He's the author of the award-winning book, The Democratic Wish, and he is the editor of Healthcare Policy in the USA and Germany, The Politics of Healthcare Reform, and Wealthy, Healthy, and Fair, The Politics of Healthcare for a Good Society. His latest book is The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. So not only does Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, appear to have a kind of hidden strength, as we all know, and I think we discussed this in the past, James, that Obama did not sell it very well, if at all. And you recall when it was launched, the website crashed, etc. So it was not without its teething problems, but it seems to have kind of formed a critical mass where there's a lot of support for it, and it's surprisingly so. But there's also a lot of support for Medicaid. And even though Medicaid is often cast as a poor people's program, my understanding is that a lot of middle-class families rely on Medicaid for their elderly parents in retirement homes.
That's the million-dollar question. You've really put your finger in on the critical thing. That one thing this legislation tried to do was not just repeal Obamacare, but roll back Medicaid. Medicaid, the federal government now pays each state for as many people as are enrolled in the Medicaid program, and it's determined by state-level administrators within federal guidelines. So it's basically the more people you've got in Medicaid, the more the federal government pays. And what they tried to sneak in was, no, we're going to limit that. Now we're going to limit your payments. So if you're a generous state, you would have limited payments for Medicaid. The problem is Medicaid covers more people than any other program, not only in the United States, I would bet in the world, 77 million people at any one time are covered by Medicaid. It is the largest source of funding for nursing homes. Indeed, the nursing home industry emerged as a direct consequence of the passage of Medicaid. No one expected this, but the money was there for it, and we didn't really have a nursing home industry back in 1966 when Medicaid was implemented. And by 1976, there was a full-blown industry. Now, when you start taking an axe to Medicaid, you're not just paying, you're not just taking an axe to a program that pays for a lot of the working poor. You're taking an axe to the largest single funder of the entire nursing home industry. In a lot of the Medicaid funding, as much as 80% in some western rural states like Idaho, goes to people over 65. Who are also Medicare recipients. So this is a program that's very large, that's governed by the states. And so you have each state shaping it to local political demands and needs. And one of the really one of the foundational pillars of American healthcare. It's got more people signed up than the American private insurance industry. So this is a major, major program. And I just thought one of the most remarkable stories was that the House was able to pass fundamental change on this pillar of the American healthcare system without anybody really talking much about Medicaid. It was all about the exchanges, the other part of Obamacare that you mentioned earlier. But Medicaid went right under the radar screen. The senators who are more deeply versed in healthcare heard from their governors, like, don't you touch that program. And I think that was the thing, more than anything else, that really doomed the Senate bill. They couldn't resist, the Republicans couldn't, to try to actually rewrite the Medicaid program while they were trying to roll back Obamacare. So they made a Dagwood sandwich and then added another half dozen layers when they threw Medicaid into the mix. And that was a huge miscalculation on their part to try to redo that part of it. But as you say, I think that's one of the great stories. And now, if you're a liberal and you've been fighting for single payer all along and you thought, look, this Medicare for all, that's got to be the way to go, all of a sudden the thought ought to insert itself that maybe Medicaid for all is the way to go. After all, it's a federal-state program. Each state designs its own, very generous in a place like California. In Connecticut, it goes almost 200% of poverty. You can be making $50,000 for a family of four and get covered in Connecticut. Very different program in, say, Arkansas. But you could cover an awful lot of the American population through Medicaid. So now when you think what the boomerang of this latest debate has been, if you're a liberal, you have to be looking at this Medicaid program and saying, Obama did something extraordinary. He extended it in a way that covers many more people and more systematically. If, for example, you have no children, in most states you couldn't get Medicaid before. Now you can if you are under 133% of the poverty line. So that systematized it up to a point. But I would call on liberals to start taking a very hard look at Medicaid, which is a program that is now had the spotlight shown on it, only to find out even conservative Republican governors don't want you messing with their Medicaid programs. It's quite a testimony to Lyndon Johnson's vision back in 1965 when he shoved that into Medicare at the last minute.
Well, it clearly was Paul Ryan's doing to defund Medicaid. He basically took the tax off the wealthiest in the Affordable Care Act and made up for it by cutting Medicaid. And he was quite proud about it. He actually said, you know, finally we've cut a big government program. But this is what I want to understand from you, because you've talked, your work is also on morality in politics. If we didn't have Medicaid or if we didn't have Social Security, how would we be able to take care of our elderly parents in their retirement if they didn't have a Social Security for retirement and if they don't have nursing homes subsidized by Medicaid? I mean, it's crazy, isn't it? Have they really thought about how families have to make these calculations in order to survive?
Yeah, another million-dollar question. But before we get to that, all the news eclipsed the one little news item of Mr. Bannon, Trump's advisor in the White House, who called Paul Ryan, apparently, a life form that was formed in a Petri dish incubated at the Heritage Foundation. So a grand insult at Paul Ryan for just being a policy wonk with no heart and soul, and from Steve Bannon, of all people. But your question goes to what I think really is the single most important question for Republicans to answer. I think Democrats are clear, which is a good society takes care of everyone one way or another, either find a way for private markets to do it or let the governments do it. That insurance means when you get old and sick, there'll be we as a society will make sure you don't sort of perish in an alleyway by yourself. All wealthy modern societies, all countries in the OECD have a quite advanced system of thinking about this. What do Republicans think about that? What do you do with people who, like all of us, like everyone, will get old and sick? There was a remarkable exchange that got very little press when the ACA was before the Supreme Court. And the argument from the Obama administration made by Mr. Varelli was, listen, we have to require payment because we as a society have decided that you don't just let people die. So we've got to put everybody in an insurance pool because we're all paying for this. And Scalia interrupted him quite rudely, I thought, and said, why? We don't have to agree to that. We don't have to do that. What he was saying, and it really was the first time I've heard this in American politics, what Scalia was saying was he didn't agree with this idea that we have to find some care for everyone. And I think there's a philosophic question that the Republicans, in all their fury at Obama and Obamacare, have not confronted, most of them. And that is, where do you stand on this idea that we're all going to get sick, we're all going to get old, many of us will not be able to afford the care we are going to need, many of our parents won't be able to afford that care, what do we do? Democrats are very clear, they just don't know how, but they know what their values are. And Republicans, I think, are deeply divided. And there are some, I think, and I would put Senator Cruz from Texas in this category, along with Scalia, and along, I think, with the Secretary of Health and Human Services, based on what he said before, Tom Price, a category that says, no, we don't as a society owe it to one another's members to take care of them in the time of sickness and old age and ill health. And, you know, that's a deep, fundamental philosophic question. And I think Republicans are going to have to get straight on that. That lay under, I think, all of this debating that, as you said, Paul Ryan was very proud of himself. He designed a system that would remarkably cut back government, and all he could think of was, I hate government, this is cutting it back. And it took three women in the Senate, shut out of the closed-door conversations, three senators to say, wait, you know, they implicitly said, we're not going to take health care away from people who need it. So that's a conversation that we have had under the table during this debate. But I think Democrats are clear on this, and Republicans are deeply divided, though very few of them will actually come forward and say what Scalia said, which is, I am not my brother or sister's keeper. But boy, that's the big one, and that's a conversation we had implicitly but not explicitly in the last couple of months.
Well, James Maroon, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Always fun to talk to you.
Thank you, James. And again, I've been speaking with James Maroon, who's a professor of political science and urban studies at Brown University, noted for his analysis of popular participation and morality in American politics and his work on health policies. He is the author of the award-winning book, The Democratic Wish, and he's the editor of Healthcare Policy in the USA and Germany, The Politics of Healthcare Reform, and Wealthy, Healthy, and Fair, The Politics of Healthcare for a Good Society. His latest book is The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining why the Republicans are having such a hard time repealing and replacing Obamacare.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all.
We don't care. We don't.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now, Jonathan Cohn, who is a senior correspondent at the Huffington Post, who was formerly a senior editor at the New Republic and an executive editor of the American Prospect. He's the author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Republicans Have a Way Out of Their Healthcare Mess, Working with Democrats. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Cohn.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show.
Well, thanks, Jonathan. And the option of working with the Democrats has always been there. Donald Trump, of course, blamed them, or at least his spokesman, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, blamed the Democrats for everything that's gone wrong, saying that they're not cooperating. And the Democrats have made it clear that they don't want to see Obamacare eviscerated and not replaced with anything that's short of an improvement. So what did you make of the arm-twisting that went on in the White House today with the lunch that Donald Trump hosted for the Republican senators, where he said, my friends, they really were and are. They might not be for much longer, but that's okay. And, of course, sitting right next to him was Senator Dean Heller of Nevada, who was clearly the person that was being put on the hot seat, if not intimidated. What did you make of it?
Yeah, well, I think your read is spot on. I think they are trying to, you know, the Trump administration wants to apply whatever pressure they can to get a bill through, and they are not subtle. I think they are, you know, Trump is signaling very clearly that he will go after people who vote no on this. We've had reports in the last 24 hours that a couple of conservative groups, I don't want to name names because I can't remember which of the groups actually came out and said this, but they would be, these very conservative, well-funded interest groups would be targeting Senators Capito, Murkowski, and Portman, who are among the three who have said they would oppose one of the repeal bills. I mean, it's all very fluid and complicated. You know, I literally minute to minute, this seems to change. Since last week, you know, the bill was, you know, they were debating whether they were going to vote this week on this repeal bill that the leadership had proposed, and then added the amendment with Ted Cruz. Then John McCain was sick, so they said they were going to postpone the vote. Then more senators came out against this. They said, hey, let's just forget about this, but now we're just going to vote on a straightforward just repeal without a replacement. Then we had this meeting at the White House. Then it was, well, maybe now we'll vote on the leadership bill after all, or maybe we won't. Let's get everyone into a room. Let's talk about it. I mean, it's a very complicated situation. And frankly, I think the White House, my read on Donald Trump in particular, is that he didn't really care what the bill says. He wants to have a signing ceremony. He wants to have a bill that he can say repeals the Affordable Care Act. I'm sorry, that repeals Obamacare. It's very important to call it Obamacare for him, because that's, I think, what this is about. And however he gets to that point is fine with him.
Well, is that to say then that this man, who I think has a history of unbridled selfishness and egomania, basically is willing to cut 22 million people loose, doesn't care what happens to them, as long as he can have a signing ceremony? That seems to be the optics here and the subtext. And does that mean that the question is now how craven these Republicans, who are getting heat from their constituents, at the same time pressure from their donors, and I believe that the Koch brothers are behind some of these threats with FreedomWorks, etc., that you alluded to. So clearly, after 7 years of trying to overturn the Affordable Care Act, they are feeling a little embarrassed, I imagine. But on the other hand, what do they owe this guy? Do they really, is his success tied in with their success, or can they outlive him?
Yeah, you know, it's a very interesting question, the sort of the political calculus that Republican senators must be weighing right now. I mean, let's leave apart whatever their substantive preferences, you know, how much they care about, you know, whether they, you know, whatever their beliefs, however conservative, however moderate, however much they are worried about the people who have insurance now under the program and would be without it with you know, if there was repeal, how much they worry about people who are, well, let's put that all aside and just look at the political equation. I mean, you sort of stacked it up there, right? I mean, they have donors pressing them very hard to repeal. They have, and, you know, they don't want to look like they've failed, like they, you know, it makes them look silly after 7 years of saying this is the worst thing ever, we have to repeal it, now they have a chance to and they don't. At the same time, there are very real consequences, particularly for the senators who are against it, Portman in Ohio, Capito in West Virginia, Murkowski in Alaska, Heller in Nevada. These are states where a very large share of the population really depends on the Affordable Care Act for coverage, has benefited, but whatever it's done well, you know, whether it, on the whole it's been good or bad, you can argue, you know, different people argue that. A lot of people, their constituents depend on. And then you have Trump, and, you know, look, if I were a Republican lawmaker right now, would I, you know, would I have faith that Trump is going to be in my corner? I mean, you know, he told everyone in the House to go vote for that bill, and then he came out and said it was mean. You know, on Tuesday, he said all kinds of different things that could get pulled out. You know, this bill is great. This bill is, you know, this is what it needs. Today he's saying it needs more money. You know, and he's always referring to Republicans as they. I mean, if I'm a Republican and I'm going to go walk the plank, you know, as they say in politics, am I going to walk the plank on behalf of a president who has shown no particular loyalty, you know, to his own party? And, you know, if you believe, as many of the experts predict, that this bill will have bad results, you know, what, you know, if it's going to hurt a lot of people, do you expect Trump to get your back then? Or do you expect Trump to say, hey, it wasn't my bill, Congress wrote it, blame those guys, don't blame me? I mean, that's a, it's an interesting question.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Cohn, who's a senior correspondent at the Huffington Post, who is formerly a senior editor at the New Republic and an executive editor of the American Prospect. He is the author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price, and he has an article at the Huffington Post, Republicans Have a Way Out of Their Healthcare Mess Working with Democrats. Now, just to touch on your article, it doesn't look likely, right? I mean, Trump basically threatened the senators today at this lunch at the White House that they've got to stay there until they, no vacations, until you get this thing done, right? So no mention of working with the Democrats.
Yeah, no, no interest. And opportunities have existed the whole way along. I mean, look, Democrats want nothing to do with repeal. Let's be clear about that. I mean, if you're a Republican and you are determined to repeal the law, you're not going to get an ounce of help from the Democrats. So, you know, if that's their decision, then they're not going to get an ounce of help from the Democrats. On the other hand, Democrats have signaled all along that if, you know, Republicans want to drop, you know, let's take Medicaid off the table, just ignore, you know, leave all that stuff, you know, don't roll back the expansion of Medicaid, don't mess with the program going forward, and, you know, don't start cutting taxes for rich people. You want to have a tax cut plan, do that later. And just focus on the private plans and the exchanges where there really are some both, you know, some serious problems as well as some serious successes. Democrats would gladly get into that conversation. And it's real easy to imagine a conversation that would produce a bill that, you know, Democrats and Republicans could both come out of and feel like they both got something. You don't see that willingness today, obviously. You haven't seen it all along. Again, this is a difference from 2009 when Democrats wrote the Affordable Care Act. People remember that it ended up passing on a party-line vote. They forget that one of the reasons it took so long was that President Obama, Max Baucus, who was the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, spent weeks and weeks trying to work with moderate Republicans, trying to find a common ground. They actually did get one moderate Republican in committee to vote for a bill, so it wasn't totally fruitless. The Republicans now, today, no interest in that. From day one, it was, we're going to do this on a party-line vote. We are not interested in the Democrats. Same with Trump. I do think that if this vote fails next week, there is an opportunity going forward to kind of at some point to pick up the threads of bipartisanship. I mean, certainly Democrats have suggested it. There was this announcement by Lamar Alexander yesterday, who is the chairman of a key committee that has jurisdiction over health care, who said, I'd like to hold hearings on how to sort of work on those market problems, that one part where, you know, there's a good, really strong case for doing something. And that's he's known among Republicans as someone who is an experienced lawmaker. He has a good working relationship with Democrats. And, you know, you could see that coming to something. I could even see maybe someone like a Murkowski from Alaska or Heller from Nevada, you know, coming forward in the next couple of days and saying, hey, let's start this conversation now, in part to sort of short-circuit this vote coming next week. But most likely what's going to have to happen is they probably have to have this vote next week. You know, it could pass. I mean, I don't, you know, a vote happens, who the heck knows? But if that vote fails, then I think it might take a few weeks, maybe it'll take the August recess. But I would not be shocked if then you start to hear more of a bipartisan conversation taking place. And maybe at the end of the day, it's a very small bill, but it does a little bit. The even if it's a small bill, you know, given, I think if you talk to most experts, they would tell you the problems with the Affordable Care Act, and there are real problems, can be fixed pretty easily, and it doesn't even take that much money in budgetary terms. So, you know, if you can get Republicans and Democrats to agree on a little bit of spending, you know, in a way that maybe half of it's in a way Democrats like and half of it's in a way that Republicans like, and they find a small offset somewhere, you know, you can imagine that coming together. But is it going to come together like tomorrow? No, clearly. Probably going to take a little time.
But what about backing up the threats? They weren't that overt, but they were pretty clear, particularly to Senator Dean Heller sitting next to Trump. And there was some nervous laughter, of course, throughout the caucus, having lunch with him in the White House today. For example, if he goes after Heller and the Kochs or whichever other right-wing group put up somebody to the right of Heller, which is what they're threatening to do, maybe he would then move to the left and be more electable. Isn't that, he's making the calculus, isn't he, that my constituents are going to be hurt by this, and I can't hang them out to dry, and I got to defy my donor base in order to protect my voting base.
Yeah, you know, the calculation that Heller has to go through is sort of involved, is fairly, you know, it's got a bunch of different variables he's got to work in there. I think it's absolutely true. He's the most vulnerable Republican running in 2018. Nevada is a Democratic state moving more Democratic. He's in trouble already. You know, clearly, I think for his purposes, from a what is good for the what will the electorate of Nevada, what will his voters think? I think if that were the only variable, absolutely standing up to Trump is the best thing he could do. I mean, that is not a state that loves Trump. The flip side is, as you said, you know, where is the money in that race? You know, how much of it, you know, how much does he get? Does he need Koch brother money, et cetera? And, you know, there's, you know, if you really want to, this is way off of my, I'm not a specialist on the politics, but, you know, at some point is he considered so vulnerable that he basically figures, well, you know, at this point, I'm less interested in winning my election. I'm going to lose it anyway, and more interested in who's going to set me up nicely afterwards. I have no idea. I don't know anything about Heller, so I don't want to, like, not suggesting he's, like, that shady or craven. But, you know, who knows? Who knows? There's a lot of different factors in there. You know, a lot of things being said quietly, I'm sure, that are not public. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see. But from a, you know, in terms of, if he were looking strictly at what's going to make Nevada voters happy, I would have to think standing up to Trump helps him in Nevada. I don't think that hurts him. I think same probably for Murkowski in Alaska. You know, she's very independent. She won as a write-in candidate who was sort of, you know, spurned by the Republican establishment at one point. I don't think she, you know, it doesn't hurt her to be standing up to Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump. I think she looks good doing that. You know, I don't know with Portman and Capito and some of the others, it's a little bit different. And obviously, you have loyalties to McConnell and all of that. And look, these are conservative lawmakers at the end of the day. I mean, they really don't like the Affordable Care Act. I don't think they're dying to keep it in place. Although, again, they are confronted with the fact that they've been bashing it. They've said they don't like it, but they got hundreds of thousands of their own constituents, all of them, who really, you know, have come to depend on that law. You know, and Capito often says in West Virginia, which has, I don't remember the exact number, but it's a very high number of people now qualify for Medicaid because so many people are struggling there. And Medicaid is their lifeline for health care. In many cases, it finances opioid addiction treatment. She has made the point that the number of people who got insurance through the Affordable Care Act's expansion of Medicaid is considerably larger than her margin of victory in the last Senate election. So, you know, she's aware of that for reasons that are both practical and political.
Well, just back on the threats made today, particularly to Senator Dean Heller, who was sitting next to Trump. Trump said, you know, that he wants to remain a senator, doesn't he? Pointing it at Heller sitting next to him, and then went on to say, senators who vote against starting debate is really telling America that you're fine with Obamacare. Now,
right.
So that was less than subtle, but I'm just trying to get my head around, I don't know enough about the election system in Nevada. If it were an open primary, then Heller could survive with Democratic votes. But if it was a closed Republicans-only primary, that's the theory, isn't it, of the Koch brothers' theory of primering you with somebody further to the right?
That's right. It's a primary challenge threat, and, you know, maybe they can carry it out. I don't know. I don't know enough about Nevada politics either.
Right.
In general, I will say this, though. I mean, you don't want to look – I mean, typically these threats are delivered a little more subtly. I mean – It doesn't make Heller more eager if anything, being threatened publicly makes it harder for Heller to change his mind, because now he looks weak, right? I mean, you know, if you want to do this, you want to deliver the threat privately so that he doesn't, you know, it's not out there that he's been threatened in this way. So, I mean, now if he flips, you know, it's like, well, he was threatened and he caved. That doesn't look good.
Right. So what's your sense then? You think that there's still a chance that they could do something? Because my understanding is that McConnell is playing a kind of deceptive game here. He's making compromises to try and get this thing passed one way or the other, but he's getting pushed from the right and from the left within his own caucus, both whom, you know, are pressuring in different directions. But my understanding is that whatever these concessions he makes to make it more palatable, either to Susan Collins or to Rand Paul, I don't know how you could do it to both, but apparently that's the challenge. He's going to renege on a lot of this stuff when it goes to conference, because the House bill is so disgusting. So isn't that what's going on here, that whatever they pass is just a means to get a bill passed, but it's not going to be what comes out of the sausage machine at the end?
No, so there actually, the rumor is, the reports are, and actually a few House members have said this more or less explicitly, they're going to just try to ram this through the House. There's not going to be a conference committee that they will pass this and get the House. They'll say to the House, this is all we can get through the Senate, yay or nay, and probably the House will go along.
So you don't think that there's any, it's not going to get worse. It's just going to be as bad as it, whatever, if they vote next week.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a lot of ways the Senate, you know, depending on what you care about, obviously, in your perspective, but you can make a case that if you care about, you know, sort of quality and numbers of coverage, that the Senate bill is actually worse than the House bill.
Well, Jonathan Cohn, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Cohn, who's a senior correspondent at the Huffington Post, who was formerly a senior editor at the New Republic and an executive editor of the American Prospect. He's the author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Republicans Have a Way Out of Their Healthcare Mess Working with Democrats. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.